Welcome to the Speak Up Talk Radio Network. I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. We bring you hand-selected hosts, podcasts, and talk radio programming with listening options, 24/7 streaming or listen on demand. We also feature one-on-one segments with important guests, people who have something to say that you need to hear. Visit speakuptalkradio.com. Well, I've been looking forward to today's guest, who is an expert on our nation's 49th state. Do you know which state I'm talking about? Our guest is Laurel Bill. Laurel is a third-generation Alaskan and has published 5 books about Alaska's history. Her aunt, Phyllis Downing Carlson, for whom the series is named, was the Alaska Reference Librarian for the Z.J. Lusack Library when it was located in downtown Anchorage. She wrote many articles about Anchorage and Alaska for national magazines and newspapers, and she won many national awards for her work. Laurel inherited her body of work following her death in 1993, and when she saw the quality and extent of what her Aunt Phil had done, she knew she had to share the stories. That's what motivated her to return to college at age 48, as she knew she needed to gain the literary tools necessary to do the job right. Laurel earned her degree in journalism with a minor in history from the University of Alaska Anchorage in 2003, took an internship with Alaska Newspapers, became one of its main reporters, and started an Alaska history column titled Aunt Phil's Trunk. The column continues to be printed in the Senior Voice monthly newspaper, and she's here today to share her books and all things Alaska. So welcome to the show, Laurel.
Hi, good morning, or good afternoon, I guess it is there.
Yes, we're in different time zones, aren't we? Laurel, how smart and impressive that you knew to return to college in order to do justice to your aunt's life work. How was that, going back to school at age 48?
Oh, I tell you, I was scared to death. My previous life, before becoming an author, I was the assistant general manager for Bristol Bay Telephone Cooperative in remote little village of King Salmon, Alaska, where we lived for 23 years. Only 350 people lived there. But I had gone through the ranks of the phone industry and learned a lot, and I did great business letters. But when I found my aunt's work, I realized that my training as an executive had no bearing whatsoever on writing stories that people would actually want to read. And so knowing that I needed to gain certain tools to be able to put words together that people would then turn the page to continue reading, and that's why I went back to school. But I was scared to death. I never thought I was smart enough to go to college, even with everything I had accomplished before that. But, you know, once I got my toe in the water, so to speak, and took a few classes and realized how much wondrous information there was out there to learn, I found myself becoming a human sponge. I could not learn enough. So I continued 4 years later and ended up with a 3.99 GPA, which was just wondrous. The only B I got was for fun class I took on murder mystery writing with famed Alaska murder mystery author Sue Henry. But I would encourage anybody out there who's been thinking about it and haven't quite decided if they should do it, even if it's just for you, by gosh, give it a shot, because it certainly turned out to be a lot of fun for me.
You know, that shows a lot of dedication to that project. It wasn't like you just dug in and thought, all right, I'm just going to do this. I mean, you realized that you needed to get that background in order to do the proper job for the project. And secondly, I think it would be glorious if everybody could actually go to college when they were 48 and 50, because by then you're really dedicated to going to class and paying attention and really, as you say, becoming a sponge at that time. Who wants to do that when they're 20? But by the time you're 50, you're ready for that kind of exposure.
That's really true. You know, and I've heard the old adage, it says sometimes people think that education is wasted on the young. And in a way, it's true. I mean, in this day and age, we certainly need to have our youth educated to continue on to be the leaders of our country and our companies. But college, as we well know, most of the people that attend at an early age, it's just like getting to know your social environment, learning how to react with people. And, of course, there's a lot of other extracurricular activities that kind of seem to take precedence over actually learning. But as you get older, you've been through all that. So, yes, learning certainly becomes much more important and something you can dedicate yourself to. And it seems to be a little bit easier because you have all those life lessons behind you already.
Yep. Absolutely. So anyone listening who's thinking about going back to school, let's learn from Laurel, right?
That's right.
All right. So you gathered all of this information from your late aunt. Why did you then feel the need to write these books?
Well, as you said earlier, when you introduced me, I started it as a newspaper column, and it soon became one of the most popular columns in the paper. And so when that particular newspaper went out of business at the end of 2004, I had people clamoring for more information on Alaska, and I thought, well, gosh, maybe we can put these columns in, maybe flesh them out a little bit, do a little bit more research, and actually publish a book. And so I laid out all of my aunt's stories on my living room, kitchen, and dining room floor, put them in chronological order, and then I realized my aunt had left a few holes. If I was going to do this, I wanted it to actually be a good look at Alaska, all over Alaska, not just any specific places. So one of the holes I saw was she had never written about Juneau. Well, Juneau is our capital. And I thought the people of Southeast Alaska, where Juneau is located, might be a little bit concerned if they were not included in Alaska history. So I went ahead and researched, and then I attempted to write in the manner in which my aunt had written. And in this way, I thought if I could fill in the holes and put it all together in chronological order, the reader would not be disrupted with a different style of writing every other chapter or so. And then once I kind of got a lot of my ideas down, I thought, well, gosh, you know, I think it might even be a little bit more impactful if I could find photographs that would also help tell the stories. So I went through thousands and thousands of historical photographs at museums and libraries and universities, and then picked, oh gosh, probably about 350 to 400 historical photos to blend in with the stories. Well, that led me for Alaska's history in the first book. Now remember, I thought I only had one book at this point, but I ended up at page 350 or so, and I had only reached close to the Klondike Gold Rush. And so I stopped the book there because I thought, gosh, you know, if I go any further, people are going to have a wheelbarrow to haul this book around in. So that's the first book came out in May of 2006, and it goes from the early days where the Native people first arrived in Alaska, features the Russians showing up in the 1700s and what impact they had on the Alaskan Native people, as well as our resources, because they really wanted the furs that they had discovered here. In fact, turns out one sea otter pelt sold in China was a whole year's wage at the time for one of the Russian fur traders. So, of course, furs became a very hot commodity for them. And then, of course, we have the Alaska being part of the United States in 1867 when Secretary of State Seward convinced the powers that be in Washington, D.C., that we really did need Alaska for part of the United States, and that's when we became a possession. And when Alaska became a possession of America, that's when white people from the lower 48 started streaming up into the last frontier, and then gold was discovered in the Koyukuk, the Cook Inlet region, Juneau Douglas, and then the big Klondike Gold Rush. So that's all in Volume 1.
These are critically acclaimed history titles under the whole title of Aunt Phil's Trunk, and there's five volumes, as you said. So that's a little bit about one. Maybe just briefly tell us about the other four.
Sure. Well, Volume 2, again, I was thinking, okay, I'll finish up the series in Volume 2. It'll be a two-book series. However, I only made it from 1900 to 1912. We got 12 whole years crammed into Volume 2, and the reason for that, we discovered gold up in Nome and Fairbanks. You had the births of towns like Cordova, Seward, Valdez, all the lovely little histories that had to be told. You also had the first lawman coming to Alaska. In fact, it turns out our first U.S. deputy marshal in the interior of Alaska was a wanted murderer from the lower 48. That's what we call you all, is the lower 48. And you also had the blazing of the Iditarod Trail at that time when they discovered gold along the Iditarod River. The miners changed the name to Iditarod because it was easier to spell for them, I believe. And then you had also the first summiting of our Mount Denali, which you've probably heard the name went originally was called Mount McKinley, right, which was kind of a name tossed out from research I've gathered that there was a miner in Washington, D.C. around 1913 when our first summiting occurred. And somebody asked him, so what are you calling that big mountain you all summited? And he said, oh, we're going to call it McKinley, because McKinley was president at the time. But McKinley really had no influence on Alaska. So recently the name got changed back to Denali, which is an Alaska native name. The high one is what it means. So that story is in there, and there's a huge controversy around it because, not my story, but the story of the summiting. One very famous explorer at the time and mountain climber, his name was Frederick Cook, had claimed that he had summited it, but it turned out that his photos had been altered, and he had not quite told the truth about reaching the very top of the mountain. So the actual person to fully summit to the very top was an Athabascan, Alaska Native man by the name of Walter Harper, and he was part of the Episcopal minister Hudson Stuck's crew, and when they got close to the summit, the crew let him, Walter, be the first to get to the top, since Alaska was the land of his people, which I thought that was pretty cool. So that is number two, volume three. Again, thinking it was the last book in the series. We made it all the way from 1912 to 1935. Whoa. Because tons of stuff happened in that period of time as well. You had the federal government decided that it needed to build a railroad from the interior of Alaska to be able to haul resources like lumber and coal and gold from the interior all the way down to Tidewater, which would be Seward, Alaska, where it had a natural deep port called Resurrection Bay, where they could load these resources onto ships and then take them down to the rest of America. Well, halfway between Seward and Fairbanks is a spot they called Ship Creek, where ships would come, small ships would come in, boats. And that eventually grew that railroad camp into what today is Alaska's largest city, Anchorage. So that story is in there, the story of the railroad, the completion of the railroad in 23 up to Fairbanks, with President Harding coming up here to pound in the last spike. It was a golden spike, a ceremonial spike, that he came up in August 1923 to whack into the track. And shortly after leaving here to go back to the lower 48, he arrived in Seattle, sick as could be, and he died a few days later. So for quite some time, there was a conspiracy theory going around that some Alaskans had murdered him, or his wife had killed him for his indiscretions with his fair sex, or that some of his cronies in Washington, D.C. had somehow figured out a way to kill him. But it all turned out he had an enlarged heart, and he really died of a heart attack. But that didn't stop the stories. Mm-hmm. So that was in 1915 to 1923 time frame. You had so many other stories during that time. The big sickness of 1918, the Spanish flu that came back from World War I and devastated many of our Alaskan Native villages. The sinking of the Princess Sophia, that was a huge story in southeast Alaska, where the gentleman I told you about earlier who summited Denali, Walter Harper, had just gotten married, was on his way out to Seattle for his honeymoon, and the ship sank and they both perished in that. Other stories in that one include the developing of the Matanuska Valley. Now, many of your listeners may hear stories of the giant vegetables that are grown in Palmer, Alaska, which is part of the Matanuska Valley. Well, Palmer was settled back in the mid-30s when the Depression hit. Many of the farmers in the northern states were devastated by the Depression, and President Roosevelt decided to help them out by establishing an agricultural community in Alaska, in the Matanuska Valley. And so 202 families were chosen for this project, and they came across the United States by train and whatnot to Seattle and got on a ship and came up to Seward and then were trained up to the Matanuska Valley, where they actually established the Matanuska Valley Colony Project. And today, you see many of the structures that were built back in the 30s, the big barns and things that make our Matanuska Valley very resembling a lot of your Midwestern communities. So that was another big story. And then that one, particular volume three, ends in 1935 when we had a really bad disaster. A lot of your viewers may remember the names Wiley Post and Will Rogers. Wiley was an aviator of world renown, and Wiley Post was a humorist that Americans just loved. And Will Rogers had joined Wiley on an around-the-world flight, and unfortunately, they took off from Fairbanks when they shouldn't have in bad weather and got lost in fog about 9 miles outside of Barrow and crashed and died. And so that was a big nationwide story as well, and that is the last one in Volume 3. Volume 4. Now, this one, filled with stories from Alaska during World War II. A lot of people don't know, the Japanese actually came north and bombed Dutch Harbor. Then they also bombed Attu Island and Kiska in the Aleutian Chain and occupied Attu and Kiska for almost a year. So in June 1942, the Japanese were entrenched on American soil. And they had rounded up the villagers of Attu, and they sent them off to concentration camps in Japan. About half of them died in those concentration camps. So when the Americans got together and decided to oust the Japanese from our islands in May 1943, they thought it was only going to take them a couple days at the most to get the Japanese out. And it was the first amphibious landing that I know of in our modern military history. However, it didn't just take a couple days. It took several weeks. The Japanese were very much entrenched and were not going to give up. So we lost only next to Iwo Jima, our military people that died on that island. That was something that was never talked about either. One of the reasons we believe is because the military did not want the American people to panic if they knew that Japanese were on our soil, and they didn't want the news to get out until they knew the Japanese were off. So all those stories are in that one, as well as Cold War, what was happening in Alaska during that time, and then as well as Alaska's struggle for statehood. Many Alaskans had wanted statehood for many, 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 many years, and the federal government was against it, as was Congress. They did not want the American people to have to pay through the nose to support we Alaskans, because even though we cover a fifth of the United States in landmass, we only had about 200,000 people. So the tax base wasn't real high here, and no real industry was going on. But we discovered oil on the Kenai Peninsula in 1957, and that kind of turned the tide of the opinion whether or not Alaska should become a state, because it was thought then by those decision makers that Alaska probably would be a good benefit as a state with all their possible oil. So that's how number four plays out. And then the last one, this truly is the last book. It's taken me 10 years from the time the first one came out to get this last one published. And it only came out a couple months ago, Minnesant Bill's Trunk Number 5, which goes then from 1960 to 1984 and chronicles the first 25 years of statehood. So you've got the early days of statehood, where we were struggling to develop a state government after almost 100 years of federal management. And then just as we were getting on our feet, you had the great earthquake of 1964, which now has been recategorized at a 9.2 magnitude. And it devastated South Central Alaska. So many communities were affected. And I luckily, I tell you, I feel my aunt with me all the time. She kind of guided me in a way, and I didn't know why, to the University of Alaska during one summer where I stumbled across firsthand accounts taken by journalists from almost every community that was affected by the earthquake. So that makes riveting, riveting reading about following them through what their emotions were, what the disaster caused, what they were doing at the time, and how they got to safety. So that's an amazing section. And then in 1968, you had the discovery at Prudhoe Bay, where a lot of oil was found. And that, of course, led to the building of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. But the powers that be could not build the pipeline until they settled who owned the land. And that was a topic that the government, federal government, had put off since Alaska became a possession. Turns out our Alaska Native people had never surrendered. They had never given over title of their land. And so when oil was discovered, it shoved the federal government into a position of having to determine who owned the land, and if it was not the Natives, what land they did own, and pay them for it. So that ended up becoming one of the largest land settlement packages in the history of the United States, when about $900 million, close to $1 billion, in settlement and 44 million acres of land finally reverted back to the Native people. So that story is in there. And then, unfortunately, the last 5 years of that first 25 years, from 1979 to 84, we had several mass murders in Alaska. So I had to highlight some of those because they were so newsworthy. You had that butcher baker who was hunting the prostitutes in the early 80s, and Kennecott, our big mining community at one time, now almost a desolate village. We had a guy go on a rampage, kind of went nuts, and several others. So that's kind of how it ended. But all in all, it's just been quite the journey. It's not what I thought I was going to be doing in retirement, but it has certainly been a ton of fun. And as you said earlier, people are seeming to love my series. Mm-hmm. Every book is filled with the short stories, one to the next to the next, and then each book has close to 350 or more historical photographs to go with those stories.
Laurel, what a massive undertaking. And as you said, it was not something you planned. You just went on for the ride, I would imagine.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I mean, I just took a gamble that people would enjoy it and use my retirement funds. I mean, I've self-funded this whole thing. Mm-hmm. So it has just been, it's been quite the ride.
Well, you've received great press reviews touting the series as the most well-researched, well-written, and fun-to-read Alaska history available. And I know that has got to just make you over the moon, right?
It does make me over the moon. And even more so, maybe over to Mars. I am on the approved Alaska Studies list for children's Alaska studies.
Yep.
And so we're now getting the books into many schools, charter schools, home schools. Parents in Alaska get reimbursed if they purchase scholastic materials for their kids at their homeschooling that are on the approved list. So kids, what I'm hearing is kids do not want to put the books down.
Yep. And you dress in costume for your speaking events, so I imagine that also helps when you go to the schools or any of your speaking events.
Oh, yeah. I just thought it would be kind of fun. So I had a seamstress, a local seamstress, help me design and make a few costumes, and I ordered the big hats from the 1800s. Mm-hmm. And, I speak all the time to historical groups, to the Red Hat ladies, to Rotary groups, you name it. I'll show up and talk about Alaska history. It is so much fun, and people just really seem to get a kick out of it. So they also, our local CBS affiliate, KTVA Channel 11 here in Anchorage, talked me into doing a TV show that's called Alaska Storytime with Aunt Phil that ran July through halfway through January, and then we just started it up again filming this week. And they air it every Monday morning, and that's become a hit. And I think the coolest story I can say, I was at a book signing at our Fine Arts Museum in November, right after Thanksgiving this last year. And I'm in full costume, of course, and this little girl, she's probably 10 years old, she's down the hall, she sees me, and she just comes racing towards me with her arms wide open. Aunt Phil, I love you, Aunt Phil. And it was just took me by surprise. And her mother came up and said, oh, my gosh, this child, I have to set the alarm on Sunday night to wake up in time for her to see your show on TV.
Oh, my goodness. How rewarding.
It's like getting the younger people into history. My experience has been most people don't really have time for history until they get into their 40s and 50s after they've had their families raise them and had their careers on track. Then they have time for something else. So to actually get the kids interested in an early age and maybe carry them through the rest of their lives is extremely exciting, especially because Aunt Phil was a school teacher. Mm. So I know every time a kid picks up a book, there's a cartwheel in heaven that goes on.
Oh, what a sweetheart. And you know what, though? I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that it's you doing this, because just as we're speaking now, you just have a way of speaking and it's exciting and fun. And I don't know, there's just something that makes people want to listen to you. So I think a lot has to do with who you are and not just the topic.
Well, I think it's probably a combination. Yeah. You know, I don't think I could be quite so excited if I was making t-shirts.
This is true. You've got a passion for this, don't you? Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, now, I was thinking about this before we got on today. I was wanting to ask you, what would you say is the biggest misconception most people have about Alaska?
Oh, my goodness. I get asked all the time. I do a lot of traveling, of course. Well, what's your weather like? Well, again, Alaska, people think it's just a land of ice and snow. But as I said earlier, we do cover a fifth of the United States in landmass. So just like in the lower 48, depends on where you are as to what the weather is like. Mm-hmm. In Anchorage this year, for instance, normally we do not even plant our first flower until May 31st because the weather usually is still freezing at nighttime and the ground is somewhat frozen. This year it has been in the 60s and 70s for 3 weeks and that weather looks to be continuing. We've mowed our grass twice already. It's just nuts. But if you go further north into Barrow, Point Hope, up around where the pipeline is on the north slope, it's usually pretty chilly up there. Their warm temperature might be about 32 to 45 degrees, okay. You know, depending on what time of the year. It's not dark all the time. Even in Barrow, where the sun goes down in November and doesn't rise again for several months, they pretty much have like a twilight. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just pitch black. 24 hours of sunlight, yes, you do see that up in the interior of Alaska. Here in Anchorage, our longest day actually is just close to 20 hours in mid-June. People always wonder, well, how do you sleep when it's light out all the time? Well, we get blackout shades on our windows. I used to use tinfoil before they made blackout shades, mm-hmm. So the kids would sleep. Because you see the sun and you know it's time to get up and play. Well, not necessarily so. Other things, let's see, people want to know what kind of currency we have. We use American money. We are a part of the United States. They often ask if we have indoor plumbing. Well, yes, we are a modern city.
Interesting. That's kind of funny. Well, now here's kind of a funny piece as well. You also have a sourdough bread book, so that's kind of an unusual jump from Alaskan history to bread.
Actually, it dovetails beautifully because as you introduced me as a third generation Alaskan, that's on both sides of my family. My Aunt Phyllis was on my father's side, and my great-grandfather on her side was the captain of the steamship, the Excelsior, which was one of the first ships that hauled the first load of gold from St. Michael, Alaska, down to the lower 48 that started the Klondike Gold Rush. On the other side of my family, my great-grandfather's name was Robert Burns Matheson, and he was from Scotland. He was one of the first settlers of a little mining community about 90 miles south of Anchorage called Hope. He mined the most gold of anyone in a very short period of time. He lived in Hope. My grandfather stayed in Hope after my great-grandfather left. And my great-grandfather had a sourdough starter, which is what I have to this day. So it's more than 100 years old. My husband went through some medical issues back in 2009, and I read how healthy sourdough is for you. And so I started lowering the amount of sugar and changing out some ingredients and altering recipes to make a very healthy sourdough cookbook. And then I learned how to dry my sourdough and grind it up into a small a dust form that I can sell the little packet of sourdough with the cookbook to be able to help other people eat healthy and also have the experience of having a 100-plus-year-old sourdough starter in their refrigerator.
How cool is this?
Yeah, my husband's a cardiologist said that he was hoping the American Heart Association would take a look at it and put their stamp of approval. But, of course, things just don't happen the way you want them to sometimes with bureaucracies. But I have thousands of my cookbooks and my starters have gone to homes where people are using them and getting their lives healthy. Sourdough itself is awesome. It gets into your intestinal tract, your digestive system, and it just does amazingly wonderful things for you. And it's all natural.
You just know so much.
It just happened that way.
Oh, my gosh. So tell us what's next for Laurel Bill. What's next on your horizon here?
Well, gosh, I've got a couple things. I just recreated Robert Service's The Spell of the Yukon because a lot of people, they have favorites from, he was a poet. He did The Shooting of Dan McGrew, Cremation of Sam McGee, and The Spell of the Yukon. I researched his life and I wrote a nice biography. So I recreated that. And so I want to do the same thing with Jack London, you know, The Call of the Wild, where the dog was kidnapped and sent to Alaska and had to go through some horrific experiences. So it's a very, very cool book, and I wanted to do the same. So I'm kind of working on that right now. These are two that are in the public domain now,
right.
So I can do so without any copyright issues. Another thing, my husband really thought that I was done writing, and he's outside mowing the lawn right now, so he can't hear the conversation. I don't want to give him a heart attack. But I have got all of my aunt's diaries. My aunt wrote every day of her life when she could start writing, and I have all of those diaries. And so one of my projects I would like to do is do a biography on her life. She was a school teacher back in the 30s where she was in a little community called Cooper Landing, where at 3, 4 in the morning she was up and over to a cabin school where she was stoking the fire to get the school room ready. She started the first women's radio program in Alaska called Woman to Woman back in the 1940s. She was amazing. She won national awards from the Alaska Press Women, which she helped form. So tons of stuff on her. And so I think that would probably be the crowning jewel to go at the end of my series is to chronicle my aunt's life.
Mm-hmm. Wow, to have Aunt Phil's diaries after Aunt Phil's trunk, huh?
That's kind of where I'm thinking. You know, I haven't formed my whole opinion on what I'm going to do yet, but I just can't see sitting around. I mean, I just turned 65. I got a lot of time left.
You've got a lot of time and energy left, I could tell. Oh, my friend. Now, is there anything then that you'd like to talk about that we missed today?
Just a couple things. If anyone's interested in Alaska history, I do have a Facebook page. It's called, Facebook, what is it? www.facebook.com/LaurelBillAuthor. Every morning I post an old Alaska history photo with maybe a paragraph or so on something really cool that happened in Alaska's past. And every evening I'll post a scenic or a wildlife shot or something very awesome that's going on in Alaska. And that's a lot of fun. And I welcome anyone who wants to check my webpage, antphilstrunk.com. And if they go to the About Laurel section and comes down with media or Laurel on TV, check out a few of my TV shows. It's just a lot of fun. We have little snippets. My shows are only anywhere from 3 to 4 minutes long, so it doesn't take all day. So that's kind of fun. Or be happy to order my books through my website. I'll autograph them and get them out to you personally. Or you can always go to Amazon.com, of course, where my books are also featured. They're also in ebooks. So lots of opportunities. If you want to learn about Alaska and just kind of have fun while you're doing it, I highly would recommend my own series.
I like that. She highly would recommend her own series, and I would as well. I spent quite a bit of time on your fun website, and so I'm going to encourage our listeners to head over to AuntPhilsTrunk.com. Phil is P-H-I-L, AuntPhilsTrunk.com. Laurel, you are awesome. I knew this was going to be just a high-energy conversation, and you did not disappoint. Thank you so much for sharing Alaska with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a ball.